The process that leads to the implementation of policies is long and complex, but it is important to understand it so we can make it more efficient and use it to our advantage in our quest of saving the planet.
If you would like to learn more about how policies get implemented, keep listening.
Welcome to Green Talks, a show run by Green Hub, the sustainability office of the University of Twente. I'm your co-host Clizia.
And I'm Fran. Join us as we delve into the topics of sustainability, circularity, and the energy transition with guest experts leading the way to a greener future.
That's right. So sit back, relax, and enjoy a new episode of Green Talks.
Hi, Clizia.
Hi, Fran, and hello to all our listeners. Welcome back to Green Talks.
So, you had an interview this time again.
Yes, I had the pleasure of speaking with Florence Metz. She works here at UT. And she has a really big research agenda, but we mainly talked about the whole process of policy making and how that is related to sustainability and the environmental transition. And then she also gave a lot of practical examples as she worked on a lot of different projects. So it was really interesting overall.
Interesting. And what sustainable development goals would this be related to?
I would say that it was related to the SDG number 13 about climate action and also 16 of strong institutions.
Interesting. And listening to the interview myself, I noticed she talks about how SDGs correlate to each other. So what are the trade-offs and synergies and what are the best action plans for actually completing the SDGs?
Yeah, so if you want to know which SDGs is better to tackle, you should stay tuned and listen to the whole interview.
And stay tuned until now. Let's just jump into it.
All right.
Here comes the interview.
Welcome, everyone. Today, I'm really pleased to have here as a guest Florence Metz. Florence has a background in political science and public policy. She conducts research in a variety of policy domains, such as water, energy, land use, agriculture, health, and cross-sectoral interdependencies. And she's a professor at UT, and she teaches about public policies and sustainability transitions. So welcome, Florence.
Thank you very much for having
How me. How are you?
Good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for asking. Do you want to tell us a bit more about yourself? I just gave a bit of your background, just your research, but probably you can explain way better, right?
You did a perfect job. Yes, so I'm an assistant professor here at the University of Twente, actually in the BMS faculty, the social science faculty, and within that in a section called CSTM, so it's a section of governance and technology for sustainability.
Okay.
So a group of interdisciplinary scholars that look at sustainability transitions, all from a social science perspective, but from different disciplines of the social sciences.
All right, really interesting. And how did you arrive to this position? Because you studied something a bit different, right? During your bachelor or master or PhD as well.
Yeah, it was a journey, definitely. An academic journey, an interdisciplinary, if you want so. So yeah. I started off with a bachelor in intercultural communication between France and Germany. I'm French and I'm also German.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
I studied in both countries, and there's French-German universities that have programs together, and I studied in one of those. And it's a bachelor that compares France and Germany, its political system, its media, its economic system, etc.
Okay.
And then, so it has this comparative perspective, and then I went further on with two master programs, one in European studies and international relations, and then a second one in peace research and security studies, also at different universities in different countries. And then applied for a PhD in Switzerland at ETH, but my professor changed to the University of Bern, where I then I went with her and finished my PhD at the University of Bern. Later on, I did a postdoc, so for some years at the University of Bern with the Oeschke Center of Climate Change Research and the political science department, and then also changed back to ETH Zurich, within the climate policy and natural resource group, where I did my postdoc, and then I came to University of Twente for this.
That's a really rich background. Sorry, I was talking on top of you, but I'm really impressed. But so when did you start going into sustainability, or then you talked about climate change, or
It started with my two master theses. So I would have two master theses, and the first one was about the European emission trading system, and the second one was then about Lake Chad, which is a lake that suffered from shrinkage to 90% and has a huge implications on the people. But one of the question was whether this is climate change related.
So it was more that the project was presented to you, or still it was something that like sustainability was already something was speaking to you, and you were like, okay, if I can merge it with my studies, then I'd like to research this topic.
Yeah, no, I chose the topics, and I was interested in environmental topics, and also the linkages towards more social and economic aspects of it.
All right, yeah. Really interesting again. And I'm going to ask you a question that we ask all our guests.
Yeah.
It's like an icebreaker. And so I will ask you now, what is your unsustainable guilty pleasure? We are doing a collection of different answers. Let's see.
Okay, let's see if this came up already.
Yeah.
So I would say, you know, it is baby plastic diapers.
Okay, this is new, actually, ladies and gentlemen. All right.
So we don't use actually the plastic diapers for most of the time. We use the reusable ones, but then at sometimes for the nights or for holidays, we use the plastic diapers. And then I have, you know, this is a guilty pleasure, if you want so, because it's easier.
Yeah, but then I do remember you were talking to me about the reusable diapers. And I think that's like, you're putting in a big effort to actually commit to it. So when you're traveling and or for emergencies, I think it's fair enough, to be honest. So yeah, this is definitely a new guilty pleasure, really. From a mom, coming from a mom, that's
exactly, yeah,
really nice. And so let's go to our we have a few questions. First of all, I don't know if you want to speak a bit about your research agenda, or if there are like few projects you would like to talk about and showcase during this talk.
Yeah. So very generally speaking, my research is about what governments do and why they do it to support societies in sustainability transitions.
Okay.
So, you know, sustainability transitions, they do not have to come from the government. Mostly they come from society and the economy. But then the government can support society and the economy in these transitions. But sometimes they also fail to support. And why? This is what I'm interested in.
Okay. And are there specific projects, like something more tangible that students can more relate to?
Yes, yes. So there's a couple, of course. You know, what can I talk about? There has been a project on land use changes where we looked at Laos, Myanmar, and Madagascar, three countries that are opening up their economies, and that can have positive impact on social aspects, on the economic aspect, and can also have downsides on the environment. So we looked at these transitions from the very local level. What does it mean for the people and the environment in terms of land use changes? And that was a very fascinating project of mine.
And then I also remember you talking to me about the project of water when we were talking the first time, and I was like really intrigued by it.
Yes. So I've been working on water questions for quite some time. I started with that in my PhD research. And that was about emerging pollutants in very small concentrations that are in water because of a chemicalization of our societies. We use chemicals essentially in everything that we do today. You know, you can think about industry, but not only there, also in agriculture, and even, you know, the cosmetics that we use, the cleaning agents that we use, perfumes, and perfumes are in so many other products. And all of that ends up in the water if we wash our dishes or we wash our clothes. And some, and you would think, you know, it can be filtered out in the wastewater treatment plants, but not necessarily all of them can. Actually, the wastewater is sort of a mirror of our societies very much. All the pharmaceuticals that we take, they end up in wastewater as well. And not all of them can be completely filtered out. So they end up in water bodies, and they are, some of them are engineered to have certain effects on humans. And they will also have these similar effects on water bodies, on the and the species that live in there, for example. So there are studies showing that fish have an altered behavior because of pharmaceuticals like antidepressants that end up in water bodies as well and affect the breeding behavior of fish. And so the fish population is going down, and which has a huge impact then on the entire ecosystems and balance there. And then the question was, for me, what are governments doing there? Because this is a difficult decision to take. Let's take the example of contraceptions. They end up in waters as well, and you don't want it necessarily to be there because they can potentially end up in drinking water, and you don't want population.
One of my questions will be like, also, how do you deal with drinking water? Do you just use tap water? Do you filter it? This is a side question, but I would be curious to know, since you have a lot of knowledge about it.
And definitely, there is things you don't want to have in your drinking water, right? And so the question is, what do governments do, given that there are many uncertainties? Actually, there are a huge amount of chemicals in use, and we do not understand all the impacts on humans or the environment. So uncertainties is just an aspect of this problem, a characteristic, if you want so. And then how do decision makers deal with these uncertainties was one very fascinating aspect for me of the problem, because it is an example, a phenomenon more widely. We have many phenomena where decision makers have to deal with uncertainties. And how do they do that? And that was one aspect of the question. And then I compared how the Netherlands, France, Germany, and Switzerland, so all the countries along the Rhine, how they address this issue.
And what did you find out also just specifically about the Netherlands? So what what is the government doing about the water, for example? Yeah. What kind of policies are being implemented?
Mm-hmm. So the Dutch case is interesting in a sense that it has a history of seeing itself as a front runner in water policy. Mm. And then over time, it is not so much the case anymore. You know, there's a Water Framework Directive that set the goal for 20. It was adopted in the year 2000, so long ago already.
Yeah.
It set the modest goal that 15 years later, 2015, there should be good health of water bodies. And this is still not the case. For the European Union, only 60% of the water bodies meet this goal.
Okay.
And the Netherlands in particular is not. And you can also explain this because, you know, in the Netherlands, many of the water bodies are human altered. And then it becomes difficult to meet the Water Framework Directive's goals. So there was... The Netherlands got exempted for some time to have more time to fulfill the Water Framework Directive's goal, but it's already clear that the Netherlands would also not be able to meet these goals. So it is threatened to be sanctioned by the European Union.
Oh, really?
So the transition that I'm trying to, the Dutch path that I'm trying to explain is that it used to be a front runner, and this position is more and more difficult to maintain for the Netherlands, among others because there's a lot of pressures on water bodies.
Okay, but then, so since we were first on top of it, like, what is changing? Or, like, are the policies that were implemented not working? Or you think the policies itself are wrong? We should, they should aim from another perspective?
So, you know, the expectations towards oneself has a bit...
Lowered down,
also because it becomes more and more difficult to meet more ambitious environmental goals.
All right.
But what I also wanted to say is that what was interesting with the Dutch case is that it has a lot of institutions that do really good work to highlight where the problems really lie in terms of research institutions, but also governmental institutions, a health council, etc., water boards, and they did reframe the problem of micropollutants to focus specifically on pharmaceuticals. And then, you know, it is a more tangible problem where you can address the issue at hospitals or work together with doctors. And this is something that was done in the Netherlands to collaborate with doctors and see can we prescribe less medication so that the less medication ends up in the water bodies as well. And this is it's more of a collaborative approach that is less building on strong state intervention. And a different approach was taken, let's say, in Switzerland, for example, where it looked at not only pharmaceuticals, but all the pollutants that come from wastewater treatment plants, and then the parliament decided to upgrade wastewater treatment plants with a fourth treatment step. And, you know, this seems like a feasible thing to do, and in fact it was really a smart thing to do for Switzerland because it was a compromise between the political right and political left. So it was a new technology that the conservatives thought that would be great technology to be exported from Switzerland, and you know would promote the image of Switzerland as a clean tech place where you can also have further employments. So social democrats like that, you know, if you have a new technology, new jobs are created, etc. And then for more the left side, they also like this because it improves the environment and creates jobs.
Yeah.
So it was a real new technology created this political compromise, and then wastewater treatment plants were upgraded, but not all of them. This was actually the smart thing about the solution was that Switzerland has about 500 wastewater treatment plants, and upgrading all of them would have been very expensive. So they decided to just upgrade the 100 biggest, or those that drain into sensitive water bodies, those that are used for drinking water, for example, or small ones. And with that, you know, they had reduced the number of wastewater treatment plants to feasible, in terms of the costs, feasible amount of plants that could then, if upgraded, still achieve an 80% reduction of pollution in the water bodies.
Yeah. So,
and if you compare this now to the Netherlands, what had happened there is that the government charged a consultancy company to calculate the costs for upgrading wastewater treatment plants. And so the consultancy, they calculated how much it would cost to upgrade all of the wastewater treatment plants in the Netherlands. They are, you know, they are big ones, they are small ones, and they are about 700 in the Netherlands. So it turns out very expensive. And then, you know, this proposal was was rejected, and very quickly off topic, and other solutions were looked for, like reducing to pharmaceuticals, as I have explained before, and you know, working one with doctors.
Mm-hmm.
But it shows that depending on how you frame a problem, it can be a successful decision, and then the policy is adopted and decided upon, or is failing because of a perception of it being too expensive.
Yeah, that's a really nice point of view. And so we have been talking about policies now for a while. I don't know if you want to explain better to our listeners how they work, like how they're made, how they're implemented, and the whole process of it.
Yeah, I mean, this is a complicated topic. Of course, we could have an entire quartile a course about that. How do public policies work? I think for now, you know, to give a short answer, it helps to think of policy output, outcomes, and impacts to differentiate these three steps. And the first step is a policy output. It's just a policy on paper. And this is where, to have this policy on paper, this is where different actors and society interests, they negotiate. We think of political parties, but actually many more actors are involved in drafting these policy proposals. NGOs, but also, you know, those that represent the economy, economic associations, in different ministries, parliamentary committees. They are all involved in these decision-making processes, and they negotiate and fight to have their preferences implemented into the draft proposal of the law, of the public policy. And then once it is adopted, if it is adopted, might also fail, but these negotiation processes, they'll usually take, you know, 10 years. They can take until a new or reformed public policy is adopted. If it is, then we talk about this as the policy output. Okay. Just on paper. Then the outcome is whether or not it is implemented. You know, if you decide upon putting a price on carbon, then do we actually see that the prices go up? This would be the outcome. And then the impact is the question whether CO2 is really reduced due to increased prices.
Okay.
So just these three steps, studying that and disentangling that, is already quite complicated, because if you think of CO2, public policies are one aspect that may contribute. And, you know, you could argue, well, putting a price on carbon is maybe already the wrong idea in the first place. Or it could happen that the price on carbon, we have decided upon it, but it is not implemented very well, because for example, the idea of the cap and trade system is that you have prices that are that are changing people's behavior, but if the prices are too low, they don't.
Yeah,
right. So if the prices are too low, then the outcome is not yet setting the right incentive. So you could say, you know, it's a good decision, it's a good policy instrument, but it's not yet implemented well enough. And then there's the third aspect, and it could be implemented well, but then there are so many other factors that also impact whether CO2 is reduced or not, that are not just public policies, like, say, a crisis like COVID, and then the economy goes down, and this has a positive impact on CO2 emission reductions, but it has nothing to do with a price on carbon in the first place.
So now I have two questions, just listening to you. First of all, how much is it thought before, like also about how the new policy was going to be implemented, is going to affect and coexist with other policies that are already there? This is my first question.
Yeah, that's a very good question. So we live in times where we had let's say peace and stability for some time. So the public policies that have been adopted, they remain, they're actually quite stable. Even if they're reformed, they remain. And we live in times where there's more and more differentiations in these public policies across sectors. So they build up, you know, it's called policy accumulation. It's an accumulation of policies across different sectors. And this is a challenge as such, but on top of it, these policies, they are interdependent. Let's take a very simple example. If you have the goal to reduce emissions in the air, for example, there's on the European level the Ambient Air Quality Directive that wants to reduce NOx emissions. On the other hand, there's the Energy Taxation Directive that sets lower taxes for diesel. Taxes for diesel are lower than petrol. So this creates an incentive to buy a diesel vehicle because, you know, it's cheaper. But diesel vehicles emit more NO2. So this is, you know, it's contradicting each other. And we have many of these examples. We talk about electrification of vehicles by 2035, electric vehicles should be the default, and combustion engine cars should be not sold anymore. This is a European EU decision as well. But, you know, electrification of vehicles makes no sense if the electricity is not renewably sourced.
Yes.
And it is not entirely these days. It also we also need an infrastructure on the road, or at home, to fuel the cars at home as well. And all these directives that support these transitions are still not exactly in sync. And and this has to do with just reforms that need to happen and haven't happened yet, but it also has to do with competing interests.
All right. And then my second question would be, especially now with climate and sustainability, there is this sense of urgency. And as you were saying also before about the whole process of policies, sometimes it takes years. And then isn't there a risk that once the policy is actually implemented, then it's not relevant anymore, or it's contradicting with other policies that were made beforehand or afterwards. What about that?
Yes.
How can we make the process faster and more effective, maybe? Is it also making it faster, more effective, in your opinion?
The process that you describe definitely exists, that these negotiation processes take so long and are really legally driven. Also, how can you legally formulate it that it is accepted by all the parties, and that by the time they get adopted, it is already outdated.
Yeah.
And so this is a problem that is recognized, and I want to contribute to addressing this issue. I have inputted ERC starting grant, so this is a European Research Council project proposal where if I get funded, so at the moment I'm in the second round of it, but if I get funded, the idea would be to look at public policies on a more systemic level in order to identify, you know, if we have limited resources, we cannot reform everything at the same time. So if you have limited resources, where would be the place where we would really need to start to have a systemic effect, a positive one, to align and make all these public policies more coherent towards one common goal in this project? The common goal is climate neutrality by 2050. And then the idea would be to come up with a tool that would support policymakers in their decisions and they would see where incoherences exist, and in order to know where they should start reforming.
Yeah, because good luck with your project. I really hope.
And I'm also teaching about that.
A
class on environmental policy, and then we focus on policy integration. And then I have a group of students, interested students, working on which policies contradict each other and which are, but also supporting each other, and are synergistic, and thereby supporting the climate transition.
Yeah, and then I also remember, I think this applies also to the SDG positive interaction we were talking about.
Yes.
Because you were saying that there are few SDGs that is better to target because those will have a positive impact on others.
Yeah.
And then also I guess there could be also a negative impact, which to think about it, if I'm like, you feel that you are pursuing SDG and you feel that you're doing the right thing, but then actually maybe you're not. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Yes. So you're mentioning a paper that we wrote with colleagues from Switzerland, where we looked at the SDG agenda on a more systemic level. So we looked at all the 17 SDGs and how they relate to each other based on a literature review. And so based on this body of knowledge, we call it, we can say, okay, there is a lot of knowledge about how renewable energy has positive impacts on certain other SDGs, but also a lot of negative impacts on other SDGs, like land use. You know, renewables use a lot of land. And then land is again used also for agriculture, to feed people, etc. So many interactions, and you know, if you look at this systemically, it's very complex to grasp. And hence we used, to grasp these complexities, we used network analysis to figure out, you know, if we have just little bit of capacities. Where should we invest it to start off and have a start off with reforming in order to have a positive effect on the entire SDG agenda? It was very interesting to see that, and we call these multipliers of positive interactions, because you can also have multipliers of negative interactions, SDG that have a systemic negative effect. And yeah, it was very interesting to see that natural resources, SDG, so land, water, etc., they are the ones that if you really start with improving those, they have a positive effect on the SDG agenda in total, but also based on the body of knowledge that we have, gender is another example that has only positive impact on other SDGs. So
that's really interesting and really nice to know as well. All right, and then do you remember on top of your head also the ones that have negative impact?
Yeah, it's the ones that are more related to growth, that that then, you know, have many negative effects on others as well. And hence, if you strengthen them, if you think about growth, you know, you invest in growth, then you have many systemic negative effects on natural resources, for example.
All right. Yeah. All right. Thank you very much to answer my questions. I think we are almost finished our time together, but I mean, I do have more questions, but I think for our listeners, it would be interesting to have your take on what individuals can do about this policymaking, because to me, I feel I'm really little in front of this huge, long and difficult process. And what can I do, me as a single person?
Yeah, I mean, you can do a lot. I mean, we are voters.
Yes, of course.
We are consumers, so we can, our political behavior is not just at the ballot, but it's also in the products that we choose in our everyday lives. And we are also citizens who can become engaged in multiple ways, from, you know, engaging in a NGO or a citizen initiative, or maybe even on a more political level. There is a need for people who are genuinely interested, not just in party politics, but in topics like environmental topics, and who become engaged in the political sphere to make change happen.
And then, for example, are we talking about creating a movement and then collecting signatures and things like this?
Yeah, I mean, this can be one way, but there are so many ways you can become engaged politically. You know, if you think about social media these days, they are really polarized and dominated by parts of society that one can have a critical eye upon. And so, you know, taking back here the creating visibility for topics, for environmental topics, sustainability, transition on social media can also be a way to contribute these days.
Yeah.
That is maybe very much in line with what many young people do anyway. And
I feel that's also what Green Hub tries to do, and also what we try to do with the podcast. We also have our Instagram page, is to educate people and raise awareness. That's definitely the first step.
Yeah, that's a good one.
All right. Then if you want to conclude our talk, I don't know if you have any specific takeaway for our listeners that you want to talk about.
Yeah, become a voice and become engaged.
Oh. All right. Then thank you very much. It was lovely to talk to you, and really, really interesting. And see you soon again, hopefully.
Yeah, thank you very much for the invitation.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you would like to stay updated on all new episodes, make sure to subscribe to Green Talks on your favorite podcasting platform, whether it's Spotify, Google Podcasts, Deezer, or more.
You can also find video versions of the podcast on YouTube. We are your hosts, Clizia
and Fran.
Melania Ardelan is our editor, and the show is organized by Green Hub, the sustainability office of the University of Twente in Enschede, Netherlands. See you in the next episode of Green Talks.